and our literacy work group. We're delighted to have you all here today. We have an ambitious agenda, but I hope that this first meeting will be an opportunity to provide everyone with sort of a base knowledge of what is happening in terms of our literacy efforts here in this great state of Minnesota. I am delighted to have my co-chair here with me, Sandra Olson. I'd like her to just have a few minutes to talk a little bit about what we hope to accomplish. We have four different work groups that will be meeting during this time. We have this meeting today. We're going to be doing a field trip up to visit SCRED. We'll be having three other meetings after that, and we would encourage you to stay in touch with us as those meetings are scheduled. First, let's go around and just sort of introduce everyone at the table today. Senator Wieger, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My name's Chuck Wieger. I represent Maplewood, North St. Paul, Oakdale.
And Jen Olson, St. Senator, District 33, and honored to co-chair this subcommittee group on this very important topic of literacy with my good friend, Senator Saltzman.
And I'm Kathy Saltzman. I represent Senate District 56, which is the far east metro area.
I'm State Senator Rick Olson, and I represent District 17, which is pretty much all of Chisago County, most of Isanti, and part of St. Francis. And it's very exciting for me because Rush City is in my district, and it's pretty exciting with this response to intervention coming from them. So I'm thrilled, and I'm looking forward to our field trip.
Thank you, Senator Olson, pretty much.
I'm Anne-Marie Yunker, Senate Counsel.
Shelby McQuay, Legislative Analyst for the Education Committees.
Well, we hope that our work really moves us toward our goal of ensuring that all children read by grade 3. And so, Senator Olson, would you like to share some of your thoughts on why we're so excited about this opportunity to work together?
Well, I believe it was Senator Wieger's leadership and carrying of the legislation that is now in law that requires that we not only pursue that achievement of reading, but that we do so using scientifically based, research-based instruction. And we know that to include five strands, which are named in statute. And I think that it's I think as we have reviewed and studied this over the past year in our policy committee, we've kind of come to the conclusion that where the committee is coming from is that we really mean it. We really mean what's in that statute, and we would like to see greater efforts toward achieving it, because I believe so strongly that literacy is at the heart of all of learning, and without it, people are handicapped, and we are also required to invest in increasing amounts of money in order to attempt to correct the ramifications or the consequences of children not learning that in a timely way. So our effort here today is to both today and through this course of this committee is to lay out what we are in fact doing. Make the case for why we believe that this is a good statute and should be followed and pursued, and then what might we be doing to further expand this on a level of scale to get all of our schools and all of our children on track.
That was excellent, Senator Olson. I'd now like to call on Senate Counsel to just review some of these initiatives that are now in statute to kind of back up this point of, like, we really mean it, and things that we have supported in the past to just give us sort of a base of what is on record right now. So,
yes, Madam Chair, members, I think you just got the copy, put it in front of you with some of the current statutes. And the first one has to do with teacher licensure. And if you go into the back page, there are requirements for colleges and universities that are approved by the Board of Teaching to prepare teachers that they have programs, research-based best practices in reading. And in addition, for elementary education, they have to require instruction in the comprehensive, scientifically-based, and balanced reading instruction programs. And then I believe the next page is 122A.06, and that is actually has the definition for what is the comprehensive, scientifically-based reading instruction. So that goes with the prior one for the teacher licensure. Then the 120B.12 is the state's literacy goal, And this was amended in this past session to add a sentence, since this is a that has the schools that when they do assessments of kids that are at before the end of first grade that are at risk of not learning to read before the end of second grade, now we have that the school districts have to report the results of the assessment, because we found out during last session that the department had didn't tell us the number of kids that were not meeting the state's literacy goal. And then the next page is 124D.42, and that's a portion of the Youth Works Act. And then subdivision 6, it's paragraph 3, is a reference to SCRED and their ability to provide the programs that work with local Head Starts. And then the next one was this from this past session's bill. A new early childhood literacy program was adopted, and that, I think the language came from the House bill, but it has, the first part has to do with paragraph A with programs and Head Start, and then paragraph B is for programs for children enrolled in kindergarten through grade 3.
Thank you very much. We'd like to start today talking about the age 3 to grade 3 model, and Dr. Robert Wadle is with us, who has been a strong advocate and a wonderful advisor to us on this particular issue. So, Dr. Wadle, if you would like to start and introduce those who are with you today.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Saltzman, and members of the committee for your leadership for Minnesota's children. It's been wonderful to work with you over the past, it feels like 10 years, it's probably 10 months, and we're delighted with the direction that you're taking the state. So thank you and members of the committee. Just briefly, today, this presentation will include a number of us, but we're all focused on really the same program model. And I'm not talking about the entire group of folks that you'll be visiting with. I mean more the age 3 to grade 3 presenters. So that's going to include Dr. Christina Sharon, who is the Director of Literacy for the Minnesota Reading Corps, which is part of the AmeriCorps program. And she's on loan to us from the Minneapolis schools, and we certainly appreciate the Minneapolis schools' cooperation in this matter. Chris McHugh, who for another day or so is the executive director of the St. Clair River Education District, he, like me, is going to become leaving a paid position and moving into an advisor capacity soon. So Chris will be joining us. With him will be Dr. Doug Marsden, probably one of the nation's leading literacy educators and one of the early starters of the response to intervention model. And we're delighted that Doug is with us. Also with us will be Dr. Ann Casey, who is the new director of the Minnesota RTI Center. Again, she is on leave from the Minneapolis Public Schools. Again, Dr. Casey, probably one of the United States' leading experts in the area of early literacy. Then joining us will be Jane Thompson and Amy Lukman from the Minneapolis Public Schools, Vern Kepp, the superintendent of Rush City, and Pat Almos, a lead teacher with the Hinckley Finlayson School. So those are the groups that will be joining us today in this presentation. I'll be talking a bit about the organization and the leading policy components of the age 3 to grade 3 school. And Dr. Sherry will be talking about what is literacy. Then Chris and Dr. Marsden about testing that's new and, oh, by the way, kind of useful to teachers, and teachers love this testing. Then we'll be talking a bit about how to use resources differently, and then a couple of schools that have really put it together, especially in the K-3 area. They don't have the pre-K part linked up yet, and we'll see what we can do about that. But they do have the K-3 part very well in hand. So that in a snapshot is what we'll be talking about. You do have a copy of our PowerPoint in your handout. I'm not sure from the bleachers down there if you can see the scoreboard or not. First of all, the goal. I think, Senator, you have all articulated the goal really well. And it's important, I think, that we not quickly go over these goals like, oh, yeah, okay, we know that. The goal of all of these programs is children on target by the end of third grade. Sometimes we think children ready for kindergarten is a goal. It's not. Too many children are almost ready for kindergarten, and then they kind of go down. The goal is ready at the end of third grade, on target by the end of third grade. That's why we have pre-K programs. Be on target by the end of third grade. So the goal is clear. On target, certainly we want them to be where we think they need to be at kindergarten so that they will have a much better chance of being on target by the end of third grade. And I want to emphasize, because I frequently have discussion with people about this, I'm passionate about literacy, but I recognize that there's more to what's going on in the lives of children who are little than literacy. And it's their health, it's their emotional well-being, it's the structure of their family. Those are all, of course, very, very crucial, and we cannot ignore them at all. But our focus here today is going to be on literacy. So we're not going to be talking about have you had your shots today. We're going to be talking about have you had your shot of literacy today. Okay, just a little phrase that we frequently use. Up to third grade, children are reading to learn. After third grade, they're learning to read. After third grade, they're reading to learn. When do children start to drop out of school? In the third grade. In the fourth grade. When they know that they are failing. That's why. Another reason why. This is so important. Of course, when I say they realize that they are failures, the real thing is that we have probably failed them. Okay, the basic assumptions is that around the age 3 to grade 3 model is that each child has an individualized learning program. We often talk about individualization. And then as soon as the children come together, that kind of concept goes out the window. We teach the classes. Classes are an administrative arrangement, not an instructional strategy. Second policy is, the good news is, we know what literacy is. We know what kids need to know, and when they need to know it, to be on target by the end of third grade. Now, we can debate a lot about what the instructional strategies are. But for heaven's sake, let's not continue this debate about whether or not we can measure children. Physicians do it all the time. We know what children need to know at different points in their young lives, and the research based on this is very, very clear. So regardless of the policy programs that you may be putting into statute, we would recommend that you always make sure that whatever these programs are, that they're looking at these definable literacy characteristics as the way to measure how well are they doing. Because third, there are valid and reliable tools and procedures for measuring literacy acquisition. And we've got to use those tools. There's lots of nice, shiny, glossy brochures out there that say we're research-based and we're tied to standards. Now, this desk is research-based and tied to standards, but doesn't have a good research base, really, behind it. Frequent measurement is crucial. Frequent measurement. Fourth is a huge leap for many people outside of classrooms. And that is, the primary purpose of measurement is to gather information to determine how well your instruction is working. Teachers do this all the time. They give a little quiz. Now, they don't compile it on a statewide and publish it in the Minneapolis paper, but they're doing this all the time. The primary purpose of measurement is to gather information to see what did what I just got finished doing for the last week work with this child. But then the thing that we frequently do miss is the second step. And if it didn't work, change the instruction.
There.
So that's the fourth.
So just
key policy.
So just a comment, Dr. Waddle. I heard you speak in Rochester, and you used the example of a cow. Could you? Because that I think was really relevant. It really kind of sums up what you're saying here. Would you be willing to share that with us again?
But you must realize, Madam Chair, that you are not taking part of my time.
Well, that's I'll give you another minute. But I think that was really I have used that example,
okay.
And
all
people
right. Well,
go, aha.
Okay. Well, I frequently when I talk about measurement. Get the people in the crowd that say, well, you can weigh a cow as often as you want, and it doesn't get any heavier by weighing it. I thought, you know, the guy's right. So then I called my brother-in-law, who raises lots of cows in western Montana, and his nickname is Biz, and I said, Biz, you weigh your cows. And he said, well, sure. So, well, how often do you weigh them? And he said, well, you know, the bigger they are, if everything is going along well, you know, I probably weigh them, once a month at the most until we ship them. Of course, then we weigh them when we ship them. But if the little ones, we weigh them probably every week. And I said, well, why do you want to know how much they weigh? And he said, oh, we do not weigh the cows to find out how much they weigh. We
gaining.
Weigh them to find out if we are feeding them right. In other words, if they're supposed to be 180 pounds at 3 months, are they? And if not, we have to change the feed. That's why we weigh the cows, not to find out how much they weigh. So I thought, all right, I'll wait till I get the next question answered. And you're the first one that's asked it, so I'm delighted. So that's the story about the cow. Okay, fifth is something that we in education don't do well, and it's frequently because we don't have the resources, but maybe it's because we don't have the understanding. That is, we have to have competent assistance centers. Competent people in assistance centers that are working with schools on an ongoing basis. Remember, teachers and principals also have something else to do. It's called teaching children all day and running schools all day. What they need is competent people who are delivering high-quality training, coming to their school frequently to work with teachers, helping them look at information. In other words, helping them really put new models into place. It's not enough to say, let's do it, and here's, They need this ongoing help until they are big enough to stand on their own. And you've done that, I think, really well in two areas. One is with the Minnesota Reading Corps, which Dr. Sharon and I happen to provide leadership to now, where we have a whole cadre of we would say, some of the very best people in terms of understanding literacy in Minnesota. Working with Head Starts, child care centers, and schools, not only with comprehensive training, but also in their sites regularly over a 3-year period. Now also with the new RTI Center under the very capable leadership of Dr. Casey, the same thing will happen. So it's not just a policy, it's really these technical assistance centers for implementation. You're not going to get the implementation done well without these policies. Otherwise, after the end of 3 years, people say, well, we tried that and that didn't work either. And so we go on to something else. So competent assistance centers. And then six is crucial for this model. And that is that we've got to formally link pre-K and K-3. I'm really convinced that the creation of new and fundamentally different schools is crucial if we're really going to get all kids on target by the end of third grade. And right now, We do have some folks talking, but it's still not really systematized. And we'll be, I've got a slide in here that kind of shows a little bit more about how to do that. Getting current organizations to change is very difficult. Now, I'm not talking about education. I'm talking about any area. And this is one area that we really have to really work on, getting pre-K and K-3 really to see themselves as a single system. We have schools that have pre-K programs inside of the same building that never talk, even though the child will be trotting into the kindergarten room the next day. So, and right now, we have, how many H3 to grade 3 schools do we have? Zero. We had the Mary McAvoy Early Literacy Academy, and that was not able to continue, and so we have none that meet the criteria of an H3 to grade 3 school. So we really hope that we could improve on that. So those are, and then we have to use current resources differently. I have a hunch that you get told from time to time that you probably aren't going to have another new $1 billion added to your finance. We have to use, we do need more revenue in pre-K especially, but we've got to be far smarter about how we use current resources. Okay, the next slide is the design of the H3 to grade 3 school. When we have these pre-K programs on the outside of the paradigm, all linked directly with the K-3. Now, that can work in a couple of ways. One is, like the Mary McAvoy School, that was a K-3 school that had written agreements with three child care centers. And those written agreements talked about everybody focused on the same literacy indicators, that the school provided the leadership for literacy, meaning went to the child care centers, provided staff development, worked with the child care centers, where the AmeriCorps members that were part of this were at the child care centers, supervised by somebody from the school. So the whole program saw itself as a kind of a single scope and sequence. Kids from the child care center would then just move right on into the school. The same thing needs to be done with Head Starts. And like we have, Dr. Sharon will show how the Head Starts that are now, their children are going into Minneapolis schools and some of the results there. We'd like to certainly do using the MELF voucher resources or the pre-K legislation that you just enacted. I think there certainly has to be some restructuring of ECFE in terms of how that links into this whole program as well. But once we get agreement on what needs to be done, then we get into using resources differently, and we really can make this happen by significantly changing how we are using our resources. And I know I'm getting to run over time, but I have to give you a quiz real quick. And that is everybody in this audience. You need to get these answers exactly right. I know some of you have cheated because you've looked ahead on the score card, and some of you have given this test before. But you have to get the answers exactly right. You cannot be off one. Okay, so the first question is, and I'll give you 2 seconds for each one. How many kids does Head Start have in Minnesota? Okay, next question. How many kids does ECFE have? How many kids does child care have? How many kids are in your town? How many kids does your town have? How many kids does the county have? Well, the answer is zero. Organizations have no children. Only families have children. And it's the responsibility of all of our silos to work together to serve that one set of children and their families. Principals talk about my children. Principal, you have no children. Only families have children, and our job, our trust, our public trust is to serve them and their families. So the organization that we organize our H3 to grade 3 schools around is we organize these programs, whatever they might be, UCFE, Early Readiness, Head Start, Child Care. Those are all funny labels for the exact same thing. We just call them, we just give them funny names. Head Start. Excuse me, how sensitive is that microphone? Organize the programs around the literacy indicators that Dr. Sharon is going to talk about in 2 minutes. And you can be whatever funny label you want as long as you are focused on these literacy indicators. Second part, we have to use then the valid and reliable measurement tools. And we're recommending the IGDIs, the Individual Growth and Development Indicators. There are some other very promising practices coming. Use the tools that really provide reliable information. Then you serve each child, not the class, each child, based on what particular literacy needs they have, based on their own individual needs. You use the high-quality instruction model. I hesitate to use research-based because you think, when we say research-based, you think we can pull up a study that says, if you say X, Y, Z, then wonderful things are going to happen. Research-based simply means that in the literature, there are reasons, research-based reasons for doing things. We don't have a lot of curriculum, but the whole block is a research-based curriculum. Then the key part of the program is individual progress monitoring. Looking at, it's like when you go into the doctor's office, you get your temperature and your blood pressure and these little snippets of information that provide you tons of valuable information. Do that frequently so that you know whether you're feeding the children correctly. And then, of course, that coaching and training and mentoring for all of the teachers and Head Start, the folks, et cetera, working with the kids. Not on your slide is, because I sent Chris McHugh the wrong PowerPoint, is just a little snippet talking about measurement. And you frequently hear about the Iowa Test of Basic Skills or the NULP or, of course, the MCAs. Basically, and I think you had asked that we talk just a little bit about measurement and the kind of measurement that we use. There are many different kinds of measurement, and sometimes we think they're all the same. Tests are all the same. No, they're not. And they have different purposes. But typically, in the education community, we have used what we call norm reference tests. And basically, that's an Iowa Test of Basic Skills. That's a norm reference test. And the purpose of giving that test is to see how well does this child compare to her or his norm, the second grade, or second grader. How do you compare with other second graders? And there has to be, half the kids have to be above and half the kids have to be below in a norm reference test. And generally, norm reference tests are used for accountability purposes. You kind of give them after you're finished. And you say, well, how well did we do? And so we call that summative evaluation. The type of measurement that we are talking about merely falls in the area of criterion reference testing, where that kind of testing provides information that reflects how well is an individual performing in terms of a specific target. So we say, you're at the end of third grade, you need to be reading 109 words correct per minute. That's the target. How well are you reading? Are you reading 109 or 89 or 129? So it measures how are you performing against a specific target. Not how well are you doing in comparison to the other kids. We don't care. How well are you doing in terms of meeting that target? And that's the kind of information that's very valuable for teachers to know frequently how well are my children doing in terms of meeting the target that we've set for them. And so we'll be talking about general outcome-based measures, curriculum-based measures, and these measures have a number of key characteristics. One is that they inform teachers about instruction. The good thing about, and Dr. Sharon will be pointing this out, that these measures are aligned with the MCA2s. So they're kind of little proxies for the MCA. So you can gather this snippet of information in the winter of second grade and know that this is aligned with the MCA. So it gives the teacher what we call a prediction about whether or not the child is on target with the real goal, literacy at the end of third grade. You can administer these frequently. You cannot give an Iowa test of basic skills every week. Well, you could, but why would you? So you can give these frequently. They don't take much time, a couple of minutes. They're inexpensive. They can be administered reliably by trained paraprofessionals. And, of course, the important thing is you know the results immediately in terms of how well this child is doing in relationship to what that child's goal is. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Dr. Sharon to talk about the five big ideas, which are coming from the National Reading Panel, and then reviewing these little snippets of information that we have. Yeah.
Thank you very much for having us here today. I've been working with this model for approximately 5 years, but I've been involved with literacy and language development from the very beginning of my educational career. When the National Reading Panel came together and put forth the five big ideas, it really should have ended the reading wars. And I think there are some people out there who want to continue the war. But we clearly know now what those five big ideas are. What we've done with our program, the Reading Corps program, is that we have started to talk about those five big ideas and what do they look like in pre-K. With this idea that if you start working with children at birth, obviously, but if you took a three-year-old that was in a pre-K program, such as Head Start, such as a preschool program in your community, and you started to get the teachers to focus on meaningful literacy activities in a very fun way, that the benefit of that would far outweigh anything else we can do for those children. The five big ideas, when we think about it, is in the pre-K area, really sort of line up very nicely with what we think about in the K-3 area also. The first one is what we refer to as phonemic awareness. And this is something that came out of the National Reading Panel's meta-analysis, when they looked at all the research out there that sort of highlighted what do proficient readers do? How do they break the code or decode so that they know what that word means? And that's a very important skill, and it has to be taught. It's not something that's just going to happen. When we learn to talk, our system is set up to do that. There are two parts of our brain that are set up to learn language. One of them is the Broca area, which is very phonologically sensitive, and the other area is very language sensitive. So if you took your child and spent a little time just talking to them, the system would kick in and they would learn to talk. That early talking is involved with the sound system. And that's the beauty of phonemic awareness. It's a sound system. So if we turned off the lights in here, closed our eyes, we could actually do phonemic awareness. We don't need to look at anything. We don't need to read anything. And when you think about a three-year-old, having them play with the sounds of their language, how easy that would be to do and how fun that would be. And so phonemic awareness is being able to hear our sounds and know that we can manipulate those sounds. One of the activities we get involved with in early literacy is rhyming. And then it gets more and more difficult as the children move into kindergarten, first grade, second grade. So we sort of up the ante because we want them eventually to be able to look at a word and break it into its individual phonemes. So I want you to close your eyes and in your mind, think of the word cat. And I want you to break cat into individual phonemes, the individual sounds of that word.
Just get the practice in there.
How many sounds do we hear?
Three.
At, cat, excellent.
We were just at a workshop, and we had practices with the Dyslexia Association,
yes.
And they were having us do, which is really interesting to
it
think about. It was great.
Yeah, it is, because we do that. Everyone in this room automatically does that, and that'll come in when we look at fluency. Mm-hmm. It's an we call it automaticity. That is the key to reading or breaking the code. So phonemic awareness starts very early. That's what I love about it. It's that children early on are engaged with sounds. They're babbling, ba 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 ba, ma 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 ma. Those eventually become words. And then they have to pay attention. Cat, hat, bat, mat. What's the same with all of those? Well, they sound the same at the end. Bob, bike. I knew I was going to do this. Bob, bike, bake. What's the same about those? They all start with the same sound. So I have just described for you two early literacy tasks in the area of phonemic awareness, rhyming and alliteration. And we get children involved with rhyming and alliteration. Now what happens is, why we have to be so explicit is that children will learn a nursery rhyme, but they won't pay attention to what's going on. It's like learning the alphabet by the alphabet song. LMNOP ends up being one letter. So we have to point out to children that each of those letters is a sound. Each of those letters has its own name and then also has a sound. So phonemic awareness is hearing those sounds, manipulating them, rhyming, alliteration, and then they start moving into segmenting. And that task I ask you to do about breaking cat into the individual phonemes, pulling it back together, that's what they have to take on once they get to kindergarten and first grade. Alphabet principle, we couldn't do the alphabet principle unless we had the lights on and we were looking at the letters. So you see how we have separated phonemic awareness from alphabet principle. And in kindergarten, we call the alphabet principle phonics. So the war was whole language phonics. The war is gone. We now know we need phonemic awareness. We need it early. We need to be very good at it. And we need it to be taught explicitly. And then phonics, or the alphabet principle, we have to teach the letter names and then teach children the letter sounds. Now, this is the tricky part with our English language. 26 letters, 44 sounds. So it gets confusing. So some letters have several sounds. But if you start early enough and have children be aware, it becomes quite easy. It becomes automatic. Fluency is probably one of the most important skills. And we can be fluent in our reading. And if we are fluent in our reading and automatic with our decoding, what happens is the prize at the end of that is that we comprehend what we've read. I don't have to spend all this time figuring out, what is that sound? What is that sound? And if you see children who have to do that, it's the saddest thing to watch. It's choppy, they're disengaged, and they lose motivation. So cracking the code using phonemic awareness early, alphabet and phonics, well, and when children get fluent with naming letters, naming sounds, segmenting words, blending words, when they get very confident and fluent with those skills, they have mastered that decoding piece. They have cracked the code. And then they're able to take on connected words or connected letters to read text. So fluency is really important, and it's a big part of our program. Vocabulary, what can I say? If you start school with less than 10,000 or 6 to 10,000 words, you're in trouble, because you're not going to be able to read and understand words that aren't a part of your vocabulary. We know that there are several research studies out there that sort of have showed us that. And comprehension, why read? If you don't comprehend, there's nothing that's going to force you to read something. You're not going to get anything back from it. So comprehension is the whole purpose of reading. But you can see why we need all of those skills. We need the big five, and we need it early. And I brought this article because I thought it was in the Sunday paper, talking about helping kids crack the code. It was so right on about you can start early, it's not detrimental, it won't hurt them, and that the benefit is that they get to kindergarten and they're ready to take on reading. What we did in this project was we decided that if we want them to get to the MCA at the end of third grade and be a proficient reader, we had to set up targets or benchmarks all along the way. And we set them up by looking at what's the probability or the percentage of probability that a child will pass the MCA. What do they have to do in second grade? What did they have to do in first grade? And in kindergarten and as a four-year-old? And we set up these little benchmarks, these little probes, and that's what we use as a guide. And we test preschoolers, cores. We test preschoolers 3 times a year or maybe more to see if they're on track with those benchmarks in those 5 areas. And what we do with that information is we take it to the teachers then using our coaching staff and training staff to say, this is where your children are. This is where we want them to be at the end of fourth grade or at the end of their preschool experience. And so these are some of the ways we can help them get there. So what we set up here are benchmarks that are established in each of the grade levels. So we know at any given time where children need to be if they're going to be a proficient reader by the end of third grade. And I'm not going to go through each of those because you have them in front of you. But what we tried to do in Minneapolis was we knew that we get a large portion of Head Start children that come into our school. And we have what we call a beginning kindergarten assessment that looks at some of the same things across the Big Five that we look at. This, I'm going to go through this very quickly. You have this in your packet. It is really the technical adequacy of these IGDs, individual growth and development indicators, that we use to test children in preschool. And this is the research, but the technical adequacy of these measures. So we started following Head Start children that were a part of our group. And Dr. David Heistead, who is the head of research and evaluation in Minneapolis Public Schools, did what we call a matched sample study, where he looked at a group of Head Start children who were a part of our program, the Reading Core program, a group of Head Start children who were not a part of that program, and then a group of children who are in poverty. And he matched one-to-one across 7 No Child Left Behind variables. So in each of the groups, there was a one-to-one match of children based on those variables. And then he looked at their BKA scores. Now this was the first year we'd done it, 2004, and you notice that the PICA AmeriCorps, or Reading Core group, clearly under the 2 principles, phonemic awareness, which is rhyming and alliteration, and alphabet principle, which is letter name and letter sound, clearly those children were statistically significantly higher in their scores on that BKA. Let's look at 2005. This is our methodology. Oh, at the end of 2005, we do a little reading passage for our kindergartners. It has, I'm not sure, maybe 20, 25 words on it. So at the end of kindergarten, the Head Start children that were in the Reading Core group, 61% of them could read 10 words or more. That was huge. And compared to the other 2 groups, particularly the free and reduced lunch, that didn't have any preschool experience or Head Start experience, 42% of them could read 10 or more words. Now, I am missing, I think you have a copy of the last slide, which is the 2006 data. And it's not a part of our So 2006 match sample, Head Start children who were in Reading Core. They are in the orange. 79.6% of those children were on track within the areas of phonemic awareness and alphabet principle, compared to 49.1% for children who match the Head Start children in 7 variables, but were not in a pre-K program where literacy was taught or emphasized And so that, and that was statistically significant also.
What's especially important there is that we're working with these kids in Head Start. By working with the kids, I mean the technical assistance center is working with the PICA Minneapolis Head Starts. We have the trained AmeriCorps members there, you know, 25 of them or whatever, and of course frequent on-site coaching and mentoring. So those kids are, you know, really doing better when they come into kindergarten. What we don't have in place yet in Minneapolis is really working with the K-3 schools, although that is starting this year. We do have 14 Minneapolis elementary schools, but now we are working with, have excellent master coaches, AmeriCorps members in those sites, and so we're delighted with that movement and hope that we're going to be able to expand that. So, because right, the data that Dr. Sharon showed you is good, except it is not nearly good enough. We don't want to make, you know, turn too many cartwheels about 75% of the kids on target. The goal is all of them. So, but we're confident that if we can really, you know, change the K-3 part, that by the end of third grade, they will be on target. And we're delighted that in a presentation in a few minutes, you'll see what's happening in one of the Minneapolis schools where Dr. Marsden is just working with that site. So I'm confident that in another couple of years, we'll bring you back. In February of 2008, we'll bring you back data from fall of 2007 and January of 2008 that shows where these kids are now. That's one of the values of the frequent measurement. It helps teachers, of course, but you can get current information as well. The slide that you have using current revenue differently is just half the slide. As I indicated, I sent Chris McHugh the wrong PowerPoint, and he gave you exactly what I sent him. He should have known better. But so this PowerPoint is pre-K. So these are some of the revenue sources that are available to pre-K programs. Sometimes schools say, but we don't have very much money in pre-K, and they're right, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of money in pre-K. Childcare is a huge source of revenue for pre-K. So we've got to be working with our child care centers where that revenue goes. DCFP, so I'm not going to read them all for you, but imagine what we could do if we took those resources and used them differently. And that's what we were doing at the Mary McAvoy School, using current resources differently, and we're able to finance that program.
So Dr. Weidel, could you just elaborate a little bit more on that to be more clear, how we would use resources differently, just to really clarify that we're getting to
the
point?
Sure. Well, the bad news is in districts with high concentrations of poverty is that you have tremendous needs. The good news is kids who are in poverty generate more revenue. And so, for example, in the child care centers that families were earning or generating state child care assistance revenue, that money, of course, then was paid to the child care center. The child care centers also were doing a lot of private fundraising. Now with the, I'm not sure the right term, the MELF, mm-hmm. or the scholarship.
Right.
Those revenue would be huge for these particular programs who now have child care revenue, who now also have access to the scholarships, of course, and then I assume that you're going to continue to raise that amount of revenue. Also, when the school is looking at the pre-K as part of their responsibility, been asked to say, how can we use our Title I money differently? Now, many schools will say we don't have enough now. We will never have enough. At the Mary McEvoy School, we used the Title I money to fund what was going on in child care because we knew that those children, if they were ready, more ready, when they came to kindergarten, we wouldn't have the high remediation costs.
So it's a matter of people sitting down and saying, how do we use the revenue that we have available differently to make sure we're funding our programmatic components? I do believe that ECFE is a huge area that I think most policymakers think, you know, we need to be looking at. How do we make sure that that's focused on the same literacy targets that we're all talking about? Compensatory revenue can also be used for pre-K. So again, it takes somebody willing to say we're willing to do things differently to accomplish objectives. Schools now fund all kinds of things that are not required in both elementary and secondary. So sometimes it's saying, okay, we're not going to fund some of those things that are not required, and we're going to actually take that money and add it to our pre-K. That takes some bold action, but we've got a lot of people out there, so I'm sure that we're going to get to that. So those are a few examples. Sometimes we think the age suite of grade 3 school is up building with school buses running to it. That's one model, but another one is people working together around the same literacy concepts.
And Dr. Wadle, if I may, while you're talking about redirecting some resources within pre-K, could you take it one step further? I presume we're going to target those resources toward either the preparation of the staff or helping them to understand the approaches and the techniques to developing some of these literacy skills. So we want to get it down to the brass tacks of whether it's some additional staffing or the kind of preparation or the tools. Is that the kind of investment you're talking about?
Thank you, Senator Dr. Olson, for bringing that up. Jim Grathwall and I were talking last week that we need to be focusing. It's the teaching, stupid. That's what this is all about. And we have to be focusing on the teaching. And we do know a lot about how to teach these children. So, yes, the focus on the staff development is crucial. And that's where those technical assistance centers come in. So the AmeriCorps part of the program is in the Head Start now, doing lots of training, coaching, not just with the AmeriCorps members, of course with the AmeriCorps members, but anybody that will listen. And each of the sites has a master coach. Dr. Sharon and I were at the ANOCA Head Start meeting with Jackie Cross, who's the director of Head Start for all of ANOCA County. And we were just so delighted that we've been working with the ANOCA folks for 3 or 4 years with master coaches, lots of expertise provided. They still get the AmeriCorps members who we spend a lot of time training, but now their staff is at the master coach level, and they are doing their own staff development. They come to a lot of our sessions as well, but so the turnkey part of the operation is really, really in place in Anoka County, and it's coming there as well as at Pica. But thank you. Yeah, it's not just. Of course, you have to put the systems in place. It's what you do with children and what those people that we call teachers or whatever label they have, what they do with the children, and of course the families.
Thank you.
Okay, now just one last point about using current revenue differently. If you had the slide that Chris McHugh didn't give you because I didn't give it to him, there would be a K-3 part of it. And it includes any number of these as well. But some of the new revenue there does include federal IDEIA, the old IDEA revenues, where some of that revenue now can be used for prevention, And what we're talking about is prevention. Can be used at the discretion of sites, and that of course has to be built into their plan that they submit to the state. So that's one new revenue that could be used differently here. Another revenue that you just enacted in the last session is that some of the interventions that kids get. One of those could be receiving services from an LD teacher, a special ed LD teacher, working with a group of kids. So this child that needs help is not diagnosed as special ed, but the new law says, but they can be put into that program and receive the benefit of that group. That's using new revenue, current revenue differently. The same thing, another model in special ed is the alternative delivery model, which is very similar and has been on the books for quite a few years, but very, very few school districts use it. And I could never figure that out, why they didn't use that model. Tremendous opportunity to use current revenue differently. So there are any number of ways now that if you're focused on the literacy indicators, you look at not the name of the program, but the resources, how do you use it to address the needs of kids? We can go a long way by using current resources differently. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Chris McHugh and Dr. Marsden.
It was excellent, Dr. Wadle. And Dr. Sharon, thank you. This has been excellent testimony and a very good background in this age 3 to grade 3 model. So welcome, Dr. McHugh and Dr. Marsden. We have two other experts with us. And Dr. McHugh, you are, quote-unquote, retiring in just a few days. So we're happy that you're here with us in your last few days with SCRED.
Thanks. About another month.
But I think we know where to find you, is
yes,
what I understand. So,
thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. And I want to also thank you for passing what I call Minnesota's RTI law, which you passed as early intervening to ensure adequate yearly progress. And also want to thank you for the $1 million that you sent to us to establish the Minnesota RTI Center. And as Bob Wadle has said, we've hired the very distinguished Dr. Ann Casey, and I especially want to thank the Minneapolis schools for putting her on loan to the center for 2 years. And appreciate that. The model you see up there will look familiar to you, certainly to Senator Olsen and Senator Olson, who have been in the presentations before. But for the people in the audience, this is the conceptual model that we developed at the St. Croix River Education District that really is a way to think about how we improve literacy. And this is the model that was put into the Minnesota RTI law in the omnibus bill last year. And it really has three parts. It looks very simple, but one of the things that I think was just emphasized is you've got to do this right the first time. And that's the whole shift we're trying to do is to get so much remedial education in getting the job right the first time. Each of these three parts of the triangle has a very deep more detail to it, which we won't go into today. I know the committee's coming up to Superintendent Kep's one of his buildings to have a little more in-depth look at this, and we'll look forward to welcoming you. Just wanted to share and maybe update these slides when we last looked at them in the session last year, but this is our most recent data of our specific learning disability. And what you can see on there is about 10 or more years in which we've been tracking the state learning disability incidence, and then also in Region 7, which is all of the schools and across the whole central part of Minnesota, about 280,000 students. And you can see that basically the learning disabilities rate has been coming down in the state and has been coming down in our region. But what we've been doing in the St. Croix River Education District is having a much more significant decrease, where we, as you can see, in 95-96, our incidence was about 4.35%, and our child count last year was at 1.99%. 2%. And we think that'll kind of flatten out now, because certainly we continue to endorse the notion of identifying students with disabilities in the area of learning disabilities. But we think we have now, we're now serving kids in a more cost-effective way without paperwork. The practical effect of this is that our teachers are now teaching and not doing paperwork. It's associated with special education. The next slide just shows that, in fact, this is our special education services. You can kind of you can see here that special education services, these are all the disabilities, and Barbara Trilline will perhaps comment more on this, but have been inching up somewhat across the state. And again, in Region 7, we use that as our peer group, and this is a slide we use to sort of stay on target. You can see in the St. Croix River Education District that essentially our special education rates have been flat. That's because there's growth in other areas such as autism spectrum disorder, other health impaired, but learning disabilities have almost effectively been taken out of special education, and special education is going back to being, you know, really what it was intended for. And of course, this is the great national debate that has been happening, is that we've got too many students in learning disabilities nationally. That's not true in Minnesota. We never did identify 50%. I think it's more in the upper 30% range of the total population of special education students. But in some states, when you look at all of your special education students, over half of them are just in the learning disabilities area. And people are rightly saying, wait a minute, that isn't what this was for 30 years ago. So the point is that we've have, and I won't go over this, but we've had quite a decrease in our special education. Now the important part is, because many people, and parents especially, not the parents of our students, but parents when they're thinking of this more at the policy level, can say, wait a minute, you're that's easy to do. You're denying services to students and they're not gaining. But in fact, what this chart shows, and this is not a Mondrian piece of art or something like that. This is a shows the achievement data in the SCRED schools over the same period. And basically, just to orient you to the chart, this is the percent of our students that are above target. And again, we've set targets that are linked. We're linked to the MCAs, are now linked to the MCA2s. Then across the bottom of the chart, you see the measures from kindergarten, and the W and S's and F's, those are all spring, fall, or fall, spring, and winter, and you can see the three is like third grade, so third grade fall. So you can see just in general that there's been this significant increase where, if I can use kindergarten as an example, where we had, you know, between 35 and 45% of our students who were on target in kindergarten back, you know, say in 2000, 2001. Kindergarten, we started the measurements just a little bit later, and welcome, children.
Well, and what we did. So if you could just pause, Dr. McHugh, yep. Because I understand we have some visitors here. And Senator Weaker, would you like to just introduce your guests with us? And I hear they have a message for us as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're honored to have the students from Capital City Christian Academy, and they are excited about reading. We were talking about that, and we were sorry to interrupt, but this is why we're here.
Yeah.
And they just have a very brief message that their teacher will lead them on.
We love reading!
Well, we love having you here with us today. You know, it's always good to have children with us because it really reminds us of why we're here. So thank you for visiting us today and coming to our conference room and sharing your important message with us. And thank you, Senator Weaker, very much.
Thank you.
So, Dr. McHugh, I hate to interrupt you, but this was an important message
and
very
was.
Timely.
Thank
so.
You very much, kids. It's wonderful to have you in the Capitol today.
Thank you for coming.
This is wonderful. Well, the point is that, you know, there's been this big increase. Now, I want to emphasize that all the schools in Minnesota have been working hard at reading, and so we share this increase, you know, with other schools. Next slide just shows that kindergarten increase in a little bit more detail.
So just a question, Dr. McHugh from Center Olson.
Dr. McHugh, on that last one, is that showing that there is some diminished as you go up to through grade 8, or is that showing that we haven't reached that the children that are making the progress at the earlier levels, they haven't gotten to that grade level, so that we would see a different pattern as we have changed our ways or our techniques?
I think that's an aspect of the slide that we aren't particularly proud of, but I think it's a little bit of both. I think it is that you get the junior high effect, in which, in the national data show this, you get this plateauing or tabling out. And what you have to do is to work with your secondary teachers on seeing reading as being an important part of the content area. But we're certainly still seeing some problems with that.
So perhaps what we're doing is that we concentrate so much that you're going to take off, and that we need to check back in and see where these kids are at.
Right.
And of course,
our school has a fair amount of mobility, mm-hmm. so that the kids who are starting in the kindergarten, we have about a 50%, if not more, different group there, 8 years later. Sometimes some of our schools the same year.
Very good. Thank you. So please continue.
The kindergarten slide just shows you this increase, and you can see that in the 05-06 our schools are sometimes hitting that 100%, very near above 90%. Mark. The next graph is one that we're particularly proud of, and this is the historical 10th percentile. And this looks at the bottom 10% of students, and this is the particularly compelling one for parents when you think about the reduction in learning disabilities, is that actually we've had a very nice increase in our bottom 10% of kids who we would all agree are the most difficult students in terms of the instruction and to get achievement out of. But you can see that our students, and this is actually words read per minute, but you can see that we have raised the bar so that if you look at, for example, first grade, that light blue, and I'm sorry for the audience, it's in black and white, but what I'm looking at is the bottom marks there, is that our students were not even reading 20 words per minute at the end of first grade back in 1996 and 97 when we started this. And then this year in 06-07, or last year, we ended with students reading almost 40 words per minute. So we've had a doubling. And if you remember, the words per minute are so crucial because that means more and more kids are on target to read. This is the bottom 10%. So the people say, it can't be done. Well, it is difficult because we're not there yet, but we're really closing. This is a closing the achievement gap slide. So at any rate, I just say that it's an important thing. The next slide just tells the story of why words per minute is such an important metric. And a student who grows a half a word per minute per week faster than his or her peers will be about 20 words per minute higher at the end of the school year. And in the spring of third grade in SCRED, a student reads 107 words, and we've just recalibrated that with the MCA2s to 109, has a 72% probability of reaching grade level standards, whereas a student who only reads 87 words, a 20-point difference, has only a 49% probability of reaching grade-level standards. So the difference in words might not seem important, but they're very critical to them. So, Madam Chair, I'm finished. I can turn this over to Dr. Marston.
Thank you, Dr. Marston, for coming today. We appreciate your presence. And we're just going to ask just to speed up a little bit, because we have some people who we need to have at the table by around 12. Thank you.
And can you be sure that mic is moved close enough to you so that it picks up?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll let the PowerPoint get started here. What I thought I would do today is briefly talk about what we've been doing in the Minneapolis public schools over the last 10 years. actually 10 to 15 years, I should say. And I'm going to talk briefly about the problem-solving model, which Chris referred to, and response to intervention, which Chris also referred to along with Bob and Christina. Before I do that, I need to acknowledge a very special person. His name is Dr. Stanley Dino. Dr. Dino is a professor at the University of Minnesota. And in 1977, he published a manual, a book, actually, with the late Phyllis Merkin called Database Program Modification. And it was really the start of something special. And we can acknowledge the University of Minnesota for supporting the research that he did. And I think it's really been something to see this model grow over the years and now grow into something that's called RTI, Response to Intervention, Progress Monitoring, so on and so forth. Basically, what Stan Dino said was, we need to get beyond just a simple test-teach model. That is, we test kids in September, and we begin teaching, and we teach all the way through the school year, and what we're teaching by the end of the school year may be pretty much the same thing that we were doing in September. And what Stan and Phyllis talked about was frequent measurement, the need to measure students on a repeated basis so that we can modify our instruction, and hence the name data-based program modification. And Chris talked a little bit about some of these measures, these brief one-minute measures. Bob referred to them, as well as Christina. All of this fits into something called the problem-solving model. Problem-solving model is nothing new, nothing earth-shattering. It's a simple process by which we try to describe student difficulties or student needs by, number one, being specific about the problem, providing an evidence-based intervention for that student, monitoring the effectiveness of that intervention on a repeated basis, and then repeating those steps as necessary. And this is what we implemented in the Minneapolis Public Schools back in the early 1990s as a way of determining eligibility for special education for students with high-incidence disabilities, for the most part, learning disabilities. I'm going to skip through a few slides because I know we're a little bit short on time, but I just want you to know that there's a lot of people around the country talking about these types of initiatives, and of course it's in law now with IDEA, but I just wanted to cite the President's Committee on Excellence, NICHD, National Summit on Learning Disabilities, and the National Research Council Panel on Minority Overrepresentation are all talking about problem-solving types of approaches where we measure student response to interventions. So again, rather than just measuring a student, testing a student, and then teaching for 8-9 months, we modify our instruction on a frequent basis. There are other issues that prompted us to look at a problem-solving model in the Minneapolis schools, including our concern about using intelligence tests. We wanted non-discrimination in our procedures. We were worried about the limited role of school psychologists, who for the most part were becoming gatekeepers and giving IQ tests. And we were worried about the link of assessment to instruction, which sometimes we didn't get with standardized tests. So we developed a model in the Minneapolis schools called the problem-solving model. And essentially what we did, and I'll speed through this because I think you've heard aspects of this already, is we would do universal or building-wide screening, determine what kids have special needs, and then at the classroom level, which we called stage one intervention, provide an intervention. For those students that didn't respond to an intervention provided by the classroom teacher, we created building teams or problem-solving teams at stage two. These folks would get together, look at the data that was collected on a repeated basis, try to come up with better interventions, more intensive interventions for students. And then if our good work did not work in stages one or two, we would go to stage three, special ed evaluation. Now, I could talk for quite a while about our OCR, which is the Office for Civil Rights Voluntary Compliance Agreement, but I'll keep that quite brief also. Back in the late 90s, we got a visit from the Office for Civil Rights, which is concerned about disproportionate numbers of students of color in special education and gifted and talented classes. And they visit school districts and universities and public institutions all around the country, and they ask these public institutions to try to comply with state and federal laws by doing a better job of addressing disproportion. And they asked us to follow a blueprint, what I call a blueprint. It's called a voluntary compliance agreement, by doing the following five steps. They asked us to do a better job of screening in academics and behavior, to provide more regular ed interventions for students that are struggling when you look at the screening data. Do a better job of providing teacher training on a wide range of instructional interventions. Work on improving special ed evaluations to make sure that they're non-discriminatory, and use the problem-solving model to do that. Well, when they visited us in 1990, we had partially implemented the problem-solving model. We didn't have it in all of our schools, and I think they were probably surprised to see that we had it going, and they asked us to make sure we implemented that in all of our schools, because that is a way to address disproportion, to make sure that you don't just test and then place kids into special programs, but you assess students on an ongoing basis to make sure you have the right intervention for the students. Well, out of all of this, a lot of things happen, and I don't have time today to talk about much of it, but I do want to point out we actually developed a data warehouse in our district, a website that all of our teachers in the Minneapolis schools use to look at student data. And they log in, they all have their password and username, and they can go in and take a look at every student in the Minneapolis schools on their achievement, their attendance, their behavior. We have a behavior screener. We document our interventions for those students, and this is sort of home plate for all of the students in the district. That has become sort of the workhorse for the district in looking at response to intervention data. And I'm just going to show you one application. For example, all of our teachers in Minneapolis can take a look at the kids in their classroom, and I've covered up the kids' names for data privacy here, but take a look at their achievement on our standardized test, take a look at the state test, the MCA, attendance, curriculum-based measurement scores, and we've got a system where we've been able to equate, thanks to people like David Heisted, we've been able to equate how well, whether kids are on track to be proficient, partially proficient, or not proficient at all in on the state accountability test. Red signifies kids that are not on track to do well at all. Yellow are kids on track to be partially proficient, and green are kids that are on track. So all of our teachers have this tool available to them, and what they can do is take a look at all of their students, and they simply need to do is they can click on any heading here, and I'm going to click on our reading NALT score, which is our standardized achievement test, and it'll rank order all of the kids, sort them to those red kids that are going to need intensive interventions, yellow, so on and so forth. I just want to share briefly a couple of outcomes that we've had with in using the problem-solving model over the last 10 plus years. One of the things you heard me talk about was the problem-solving team. One of the things that we discovered when we first started this, half the kids that went to those problem-solving teams went into special education. But as we improved our practice with the problem-solving teams, as we got better in providing evidence-based practice, now only about 30% of those kids are going into special education. 70% are staying in regular education. So we feel like we're finding something that's effective for those students. And that's what that bar chart shows. Also, Chris showed you a bar chart or a line chart related to students with disabilities, learning disabilities, going down in at SCRED. Ours has actually stayed constant over the years. It's about 7% of our students are served as in the high incidence disability category. So it's been stable. But what I did is I put this on a chart with the backdrop of showing how our poverty has increased over the last, since 1993, and that's the green line, and also our ELL population has increased. So we are a district with increasing needs, and yet our special ed population with a high incidence disabilities has stayed constant. And then finally, earlier I referred to our school psychologist. This is the last outcome I'm going to show you with problem solving before I talk about Loring. Our school psychologist time almost doubled back in the early 90s when we were required to give IQ tests, but when we began implementing the problem solving model, we actually cut that almost in half. Final thing I'm going to do here before I hand it over to Ann Casey, who's got the panel, is talk briefly about a grant that we just received from the United States Department of Education. We're one of three districts, actually states in this country, to receive this funding, Minnesota, Oregon, and Pennsylvania. And so Minneapolis Schools is collaborating with the University of Minnesota on demonstrating just these things that we've been talking about, beginning with Bob, Christina, and Chris, and myself. The basic principles are universal screening, targeted instruction for students, weekly progress monitoring, monthly data review. I'm not going to talk any more about that because Jane Thompson, our principal for Loring, will give you more details. But essentially, we start with the student data that I just showed you. For our universal screening, we look at fall, winter, spring curriculum-based measurement scores to see how well kids are doing, and then we get into differentiated levels of instruction for our students at Tier 1, 2, and 3. I think everybody here has probably seen the pyramid, so I don't need to spend a lot of time talking about it, but I just want you to know that the intensity of the instruction increases as we go from Tier 1, which is core instruction, to Tier 2, which is target instruction for those kids not meeting benchmarks, to Tier 3, which is very intensive instruction. And I got three slides here which talk about the instruction, but I think I'm just going to skip over them right now. But as you see, as we get up from 1, 2, and 3, we have more intensive interventions that are available for the students in the model out at Loring School. And then all of the data is collected weekly. Progress monitoring charts are kept for students that have not met benchmarks out at Loring School. And then finally, the last two slides I'm going to show you are some data that come from the Minnesota Department of Education website. And this is really nice data for Loring School, which shows that those kids are making very nice progress in reading on the MCA. And they are the gold line. Their line is going up here, and you can see they're compared to the rest of the district and to the state. The state is actually going down slightly, and Loring School is going up. And with our African-American students...
Which line is the state from here? I can't quite tell.
The state is the green line,
the green on the
up
top.
On the
okay.
top, and that is going down slightly. And Loring is going up. So that's for the whole school. And then for our African-American students, and we've been paying a lot of attention to trying to decrease the gap and narrow the gap, they've got a very nice gain there. Again, that's the gold line from 05-06 up to 06-07 compared to the state and the rest of the district. That is just a whirlwind tour, but I know we're short on time, and I want to give Ann Casey, and I want to acknowledge Ann Casey has been a big part of everything that you've seen here in the Minneapolis schools, and we miss Ann. She's over there working on the great project with SCRED. But she's going to pull together now a panel of folks that are going to talk more about the Loring Project and the SCRED.
Thank you very much, Dr. Marsden and Dr. Casey. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We're excited to hear from you. And if you would introduce your panel members when they come up, that would be wonderful.
Great.
So, and we're going to try to be with about 20, 25 minutes if that works for you with
sure.
the panel. Thank you.
I had some slides, but we don't need to go through them. Just first of all, thank you for funding the Minnesota Response to Intervention Center. I'm delighted to be its director. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we hope to help a number of schools in implementing response to intervention. So you can look at the slides there. Just briefly, response to intervention is a phrase, a term. It's not something that you have to do. The people that are going to come and talk to you on the panel today are people who've been response to intervention, and we didn't call it that, and we kind of all have that in common. These are practices that we've put in place where we're essentially taking the measurement system and tying it to instruction and changing instruction when kids need changes. That's what response to intervention is all about, and then adding that third component, problem solving. And if the panel wants to come up here, we'll introduce them all as they come, and they this is something that we all share, even though we come from different places and different procedures. And we'll pull up a few chairs here.
Well, it's good to see the superintendent here as well, because I think we focus quite a bit on having staff development, but you have to have leadership within a school and a district to make this happen as well. So I appreciate having people who come from different perspectives
yes.
on this. That's
yeah.
that's very good.
I'd like to introduce Jane Thompson, who's the principal at Loring School. Loring is, as Doug talked about, is our model demonstration school in Minneapolis Public Schools and part of the federal grant that we've had. And Amy Lumen is standing next to her, and she's the reading specialist for Loring Elementary School in North Minneapolis. And then I'd also like to introduce Vern Kep, who's now the superintendent. And you're kind of off the screen here.
Using the screen.
Oh, I see.
I think I'll pull off the screen if I sit over here.
Okay.
I'll scoot my iPad.
Okay.
Yeah. Then we can put the screen down, actually, when you guys start talking. And Pat Almos, who's from the Hinkley-Finleyson, it's a hard word for me to say, schools. He's a teacher also. So we have a different perspectives here. So I'm, like I said, each of them has a little bit of a story to tell, and I think what you wanted to have happen is just have them talk briefly about what their history has been with response to intervention, and then you were going to ask some questions. Is that how you'd like
yes,
to
Yes, I think what would be really helpful for us is that as we look at this, one of the things that, you know, Senator Olson and I have talked about is what are the speed bumps in the road? As we look at this model, are there things that are barriers or that you perceived in trying to implement this program that would have been helpful to take the speed bumps out or to encourage other school districts and other schools to, you know, consider this to move forward? And obviously it's having coaches and mentors who can sort of train you in this model, but anything else that would give us a perspective of as we move forward with perhaps recommendations, that would be really helpful.
One thing I will ask them.
Could you use the mics?
One thing that I will ask the panel members to do when they do speak is the things that they've had in place over time that it's allowed them to sustain their efforts, because I think that's maybe been a key thing. You know, what does it take to sustain this kind of effort over time? So if it's okay, I'm going to start with Jane and ask Jane to make a few comments about Loring, and maybe Amy will add a few things too. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here. Amy and I represent the front line, the people who are facing the children every day and the teachers who work with them. So it's a nice opportunity to be able to share what we do. Briefly, we are a North Minneapolis school. We are pre-K through fifth grade, and we have 370 students. We have 80% of our students at free or reduced lunch, poverty level. 20% are ELL students, and 9% are homeless and highly mobile. So we have what I would call a typical North Minneapolis school.
Could you just run those numbers by again? It was
Certainly.
A little slow.
Okay. 370 students, 80% free or reduced lunch, 20% ELL, 9% homeless and highly mobile, and 5% of our students are currently in special education. Okay? That's slightly below the district rate. I just want to say where we started our journey approximately 6 years ago was we had a nice little neighborhood school with marginal results in terms of our tests. We had a lot of individual teachers doing their own thing and engaged in what I call private practice. They closed their door, they taught their children, they went home. These were very dedicated, well-meaning teachers who now had different children sitting in front of them than they had had 20 years earlier in the same neighborhood. We needed to change. So what we did is basically we started out by taking ownership of our professional responsibilities. It wasn't about us. It was about the children. And we had to, as one of the slides said, get it right the first time. We didn't have time anymore to go back and, quote, remediate children. There were too many children now who were behind. So we engaged in some pretty intensive professional development through the Reading Excellence Act, and then we quickly found out how wonderful that was in terms of results and our own professional learning, and then applied to continue with the Reading First grant. And so we do now practice scientifically based reading research methods of instruction. Thank you. Other university type folks, I assume. Barbara Taylor at the University of Minnesota was a wonderful guide for us. And we were able to implement those five big ideas of a progressive, incremental approach to reading instruction so that children, by the end of third grade, if they are at Loring School for those years, kindergarten through third, are proficient readers. And we do have the data to show that. Helps me sleep well at night. We then, the next move we did was to really structure the entire building. All of the activities of the building were focused on literacy.
So what did you give up?
What did
you,
give
I mean,
up?
Because I think that's an important point, is that we talk about this, that we want more and more in the school day, but were there things that you then didn't do that you had been doing?
Unfortunately, I think what happens is we don't have the option of giving anything really up.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, what we did is we all added more of our personal time mm-hmm. to the work. Teachers had weekly trainings in small study groups. That meant that their evenings and their weekends were spent reading research.
Mm-hmm.
It meant that they were videotaping their work and bringing it before a peer group and critiquing it.
Mm-hmm.
We really gave up personal time.
I don't know
how else to say it.
So,
as we've gotten better at it, we've found other ways to include all of the reading work and the good instruction that we know and how to incorporate it across curriculum now. So we've become more efficient.
Good.
If that helps.
We may need to speed up just a little bit because I know the other three want to talk as well.
Okay.
So.
Let me just tell you what the outcomes were. There was increased accountability to student learning. And I'm talking not about, we don't wait until the end of the year to see what our MCAs are about. We know every week for every child who's not operating at grade level, we know every week how they're doing and what needs to be done. We have more effective instruction, so we're more efficient in what we do. And what else we're seeing is, again, that shift in resources
Excellent.
Within the building.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Amy, so Ms. Almas, or who is speaking next? Okay.
Thanks for inviting us to be here. Nice to see people at this level focusing on some stuff that we think is really important in the schools. I'm Vern Kemp from Jacobson Elementary. Well, Rush City Schools was principal at Jacobson Elementary. About 500 students. Our free and reduced lunch count varied probably between 25% and 30%. We went down this path in the mid-90s. Actually, it was as much teacher-initiated as anything. I was right there cheering them on, but I had some teachers ask questions about, you know, how do we know that we're really making a difference? Is what we do really having a good impact? And we had the Iowa tests and stuff like that, but we really didn't look at them on a regular basis. We kind of developed a philosophy that if you're going to collect data, you should use it. And we wanted something that was simple. The reading measures that Bob and Christina have talked about, Bob Wadle and Christina have talked about, are the direction we took. So we gathered data very regularly. I think the teachers were apprehensive about it initially, wondering what it would reflect. And I would say that in the huge majority, and I'm talking 90-95% of the time, it supports what teachers think makes sense. It affirms or reaffirms what they believe and what their intuition tells them. But there are times, regularly, you know, where the data alerts teachers to something that they hadn't noticed. This little girl, little guy who was just an average, well-behaved student in their classroom, never catching their attention, might not be learning as well as we need that child to learn. And the data would alert us to that. Oh, she's not a top reader, or he's not. They'd be surprised. And initially there was some shock, and there were some hurt feelings with parents. You know, when we would say, we're concerned about your child, and I was like, well, how'd he get to fourth grade? And all I've ever heard was he's doing great. So the data is just critical. We developed a culture of collecting and using the data. We just made it a priority. I would agree with what we heard here. You just make time to get things done, but we restructured our staff development. We said you don't need to go out 60 miles from home to find stuff out. We can do stuff in-house. We'll spend money and time here. We had the St. Croix River Education District resources available, people who were thinking the same way as we were, in fact, probably leading that thinking at times. So we leaned on people there to help us manage the data. We're a small school system. We can't do the stuff that Minneapolis Public Schools can do with number crunchers. But St. Croix River Education District hired an outcomes manager to help us manage data. We started looking at it regularly. Our teachers in the elementary school met at least monthly. Grade level teams met at least monthly to review the data, say who's doing well, who's not doing well, and if you're doing well, well, we aren't going to forget you. We'll gather some data on you again later in the year, but we're going to focus on those kids who look like students of concern. Come up with ideas, interventions for changing. It's that medical model. If the quick measures indicate a concern to a doctor or a medical team, we expect them to offer suggestions. What should we do different to change my blood pressure? So if the measures indicate that the reading isn't progressing as well for me, what will we do different? That's a whole different culture you develop to say you can't keep doing something if it doesn't look like it's working. So there are systemic changes that took place over a period of time, and I've talked to different schools about this, and it's not something where we can give you a recipe and say, here's how to do it. You need to walk through these steps. We can shorten up the journey because of the work we've done, but we can't give you a recipe that you can put in place overnight. And
so
that's
you don't really set this down in a school. It has to come from the teachers, and it has to come from the principals that they have to have buy-in.
I think you have to have good leadership in the building, and that could be a teacher group. Most likely you're going to have a principal or a curriculum coordinator, reading director, somebody in a position to allocate resources and nurture things from an administrative perspective sure helps. I think there's lots of research to show that you need building leadership, and that's probably a principal or someone in administration. But I presume
it gets reinforced by the satisfaction of seeing that you're actually achieving something.
I think so.
That intrinsic value of what you're doing is.
And those folks who start out saying that they're worried about the data. Is it going to reflect something bad about me as a teacher? They get convinced that it found things that they hadn't seen. The numbers are hard to dispute, and it's not like you just live by the numbers, but when you get that data in front of you, it forces you to ask questions about the data you're looking at and seek answers for those questions. And usually that means collecting some more data, waiting for another round of information to come your way. And you'll get teachers who are scurrying to their colleagues with the new data in hand. Okay, what are we doing with, Vern or Susie or whoever? How's it working? What happened? And we're also in a mode here, I think, today that was far different in the mid-90s when we started doing this in Rush City. We were plowing new ground. Today, you hear a lot about data-driven decision-making, RTI. People are just a lot more tuned into this kind of stuff than they used to be. But initially, we had to sell this. It's like, we used to go around kicking tires to decide on cars, but we've got consumer reports and other things today. And so, and Bob Wadle's concept about the cows, it's like we measure things for a purpose and we use the data for a purpose. And so it's, why not apply it in school settings?
Be good. Right. So welcome, Ms. Almos. Thank you for being here today.
I think I might just say I think what they think. I think the big thing that has really changed is the word team. We are a team as a school. My name is Patricia Almos. I'm the reading director for the Hinckley-Finlayson Public Schools, and I teach all day. Also, I have different groups, and we are the building I'm in is a K-6 building. There's about 500 kids in our building. And there's about 100 kids in the Finlayson Elementary School, which is about 13 miles north of us. We have about 50 to 60% free or reduced lunch. And in our school, we have about last year we had about 38% turnover in the school year. And Hinckley used to be known for Toby's rolls. Not anymore. So we have a very mobile society. And it's hard to believe you're right on the freeway. But that is a thing to deal with. But the thing that we've learned through the years that I've been reading director is we absolutely have to work as a team, and we all need to talk the same talk. And that has, I think, really, really has helped our children. We have a lot less kids over the years that need remedial instruction. In fact, we just had a meeting this last week with teachers. Our big challenge now is, of course, still with those kids, but how do you help the kids? What else are we going to do to challenge the top ends? And that's one of my goals this year is what else are we going to put in that would challenge those kids to make their high school career even more beneficial for them. And we probably said this already, but my job as the reading director is I coordinate our testing three times a year. I work with SCRED with that. And I wish you could see the kids come. We have about 10 or 12 people that come that are all trained, and we remind and we retrain every time we test three times a year. We're in our media center. And I wish you could watch the kids as they come. They line them up by the door, and kids should look anxious to test instead of nervous to test. And, of course, this is all generated through teachers. They want to come and show off what they know. Not compared to what you, but what I know. Look what I have accomplished. And it's really fun to stand back and watch. We have a new AmeriCorps worker who started this year. And I said, now, watch it. Show me. Look at those kids at the door. And she goes, they all look happy. How can you be happy to test? Well, we don't think of it as a test. We're showing how much they have improved. And if anybody wants to watch that, it's really, really fun to see. And then we take any kids that are below that goal line are put on Ames Web graphs. Teachers are alerted. These are the kids that are on graphs. And then my job is to coordinate monthly graph meetings with grade levels. And then another thing we've added this year is the coaches in our building, reading literacy coaches, at least once a quarter, then we will work across grade levels also. So I would be in charge of grades 4, 5, and 6, and we also talk to the remedial teachers in the high school. And it's a problem solving, and we don't stand around and complain about kids because, man, it's easy to get into that. It's all data-driven, and what are we going to do to make a difference? And what are we going to do with these scores, and how are we going to get kids to be better readers? The other thing we do, which we started a number of years ago, is these three times a year we also inform parents. We have a form they fill out. The first one will be given out at conferences in November. Here's where your child is. Here's where they need to be. And how can we help you? How can we help your family? How can we help you, and how can you help us to make your family a better family? Because if your kid can read better, your family's also going to be more successful. And so then it's once a month, and it's once a quarter as bigger groups. And kids who talk about what interventions we need. Do we need these kids are pretty good, so we'll have a general intervention for them. But who needs specific ones? Kids who are on very specific interventions get tested weekly, and we can see how those graphs are going. Some kids are tested about twice a month. Depends on what they need. And our testers are very highly trained paraprofessionals. And this absolutely drives our curriculum. And we have a set curriculum for our school, but is there anything else that we need to add? And so, again, parents are updated, and we as a school are a team. As parents, we are a team. As a school administrator, we are a team.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lumen, thank you for joining us today as well.
I don't think I really have a whole lot any different than any of these people said, other than I have been a classroom teacher for 17 years, and when you ask about the roadblocks or the stumbling blocks for a teacher, if I could go back the 10 to 11 years that I was a fourth grade and second grade teacher and had this type of data to inform my instruction, sometimes I wish I could go back and grab those kids and do it all over again. So I don't think of it ever as a stumbling block or a roadblock. I think for teachers to be able to get the time to meet once a month with their colleagues as a team, it's phenomenal to watch. This is my first year at Loring, and to listen to the teachers talk, and like she said, it's all done positively. It's not like you're talking about the children. You're learning, what can I do to help this child make it? And it's been such a positive experience that if anyone ever wanted to share, I wish I had it 10 years ago when I was in the classroom.
Are there any Reading Corps members in your classroom?
No.
But in your school, are there reading corps members?
No, we don't.
You don't have reading corps members. Okay.
I will be finding out how to get one, though. Shortly after.
Here you go. I'm going to work on that after today. No, that's excellent. Because I know that you have mentioned paras giving tests. Are there paras giving?
We have associate educators and educational assistants, and then myself, we do the testing.
And we've had the luxury that through REA and Reading First, we gave them parallel training to what the teachers were getting through that grant.
I know that at times there are comments and like some sensitivity. Are we replacing teachers by doing some of these things? And if you could just comment, maybe Ms. Lumen, just very briefly on, you know, could you do this all by yourself?
Could the teachers do it all by themselves?
Mm-hmm. Without paras helping you? Or
I think it would be difficult. I do all of first grade, and AE does all of kindergarten. And I heard a comment from a second grade teacher go, can you help me out? Just do it. It's timely for a teacher to do it, mm-hmm. but it's well worth the results that they get. We do it at kindergarten and first grade because there's obviously many more kids that you're going to progress monitor on a weekly basis. But yes, at those levels, it would be difficult.
Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Olson.
There's been reference to the intervention and changing interventions as a result of the data driven. Do you, and the teachers, do you feel that you are, through your initial preparation, equipped with sufficient background in what those, what kinds of interventions get at the issues that the children may be having, or what resources have you drawn on to equip the teachers to do this?
I can talk about what we experienced once we had the teachers on board with collecting and using the data, and by the way, they like it. And parents like it. It informs the teacher's instruction, and it tells parents how well students are doing. But once we had them using the data, the natural question for them was to say, okay, if you're telling us that a student's not making progress, then what are we supposed to do differently? And that gets right at what you're talking about. And so we had to go out and look at research. What does research say will be the most powerful interventions? And we've tried to boil that down to, I'm going to say, 6 or 8 things that we think will have the biggest impact. We're never done looking. We don't eliminate ideas just because they're new, but we want them to be tested by research before we say, okay, this is a strong one to grab.
And to what extent do these follow the 5 strands or the 5 big ideas that we've been talking about? I think there's been a sense in what I've heard that the phonemic awareness or the phonics part of it has been there's been somewhat of a void, or there's been somewhat of a struggle on that. Are those some of the areas that are the challenge in terms of the teaching of reading? Or could you elaborate a bit on, besides the data, obviously there's something that has to have happened, and that's what I'm trying to get at.
I can respond to that from a comment that one of our lead teachers made earlier this week. He said, I wish I had learned all of this back when I went to college. Now, Minneapolis has a more senior teaching staff, perhaps, than other districts, but what our teachers had to experience was almost like getting a reading certificate. They had to totally untrain themselves from what they had been taught, and then through weekly study groups or seminars, 5 years of staff development, they were retrained using the national panels, reading panels, okay. Information.
So you did use your staff development to help equip them to deal with this?
Exactly. Okay. Intensely for 5 years.
Okay. So I would like to thank you for being here. We can go on for this will be our next hearing will be on staff and staff development. So Dr. Casey, thank you so much. And I do have a couple people who are going to have to leave here, so if we could maybe move them to the table, and perhaps if there's time at the end if people have questions. But thank you so much for coming. If Barb Tulane from the Department of Education, I know you have another meeting, and I appreciate the department being here today to just sort of check in with us briefly on what's been happening over the past few months since we were in session, and just we have more to discuss beyond this, but just a brief update, and thank you so much for being here and staying.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Madam Chair and members. And I think that this is kind of a timely segue, actually, right now, to talk about how so much of this is connecting, and it's important to connect. Both Dr. Wedel and Chris McHugh referenced what we call their alternate instruction that's required before special education evaluation. And our legislative groups and our field groups and so forth offered some ideas on how to improve what we called our pre-referral intervention law. And although we had you must conduct two interventions, there wasn't any guidance on what a quality intervention could be. And thanks to the powers that be and the alignments of the minds, we now have interventions specified with scientific research-based intervention and instruction as part of this law. And now, in addition to that, what was added was that it is based on essential components of models from research. So a lot of the words that you've already heard about general outcome measures, about interim assessments, about progress monitoring, about developing a system, and having an organizational plan are now part of the law. So we're going to be seeing that implemented more and more with support through alternate instruction before we evaluate students with some specific components. That's also part of our flexibility that we're offering with the small group instruction that both Bob and Chris referred to. The second is our ALT delivery programs, and we do have, these have been on the books since the early 90s, and these are about prevention. Prevention is now in vogue, it's researched, its time has come. The good news about a lot of our prevention activities now is that we do have an increase in these activities and the applications. For 2007-2008, we now have 35 total programs and 12 are new. So we've had a 50% increase in the interest in alternate delivery of special education. And these programs have improved because we have revamped the application, that if they're reapplying, it's been streamlined. We've updated language to include academic and behavior support for those who may be eventually qualifying for special ed. It requires a budget for review, and it requires the commissioner to establish criteria for prioritizing and not getting into any maintenance of effort concerns. It also simplifies some of our program evaluation and requires some overall program evaluation so we can show that these prevention programs are working. The third point would be that we have some changes with our specific learning disabilities criteria required by Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, we call it IDEA. And the changes there were that we must not require districts to use the discrepancy model that's been used in the past to identify children. However, we must provide and permit districts to use this type of scientific research-based intervention and instruction and the data as part of the criteria. So we have had a stakeholder work group to develop proposed changes to the learning disabilities criteria. It is published in the State Register. It's going through the rulemaking process, and there will be a hearing on December 3rd. Also, just as a note, as the Department of Education, we provide director forums 3, 4, 5 times a year. And we have focused our last forum on 4 programs that were in some stage of implementing RTI programs. Not all of them called it that. Not all of them have grants that were supported by the department. But I think what was so eloquently expressed by a couple of the principals that this just made sense to do in looking at their data to improve data and to improve testing for kids. It just made sense. At our next director's forum, we are also looking at systems change speaker that's talking about scaling up no matter where you are on your program, whether it's in reading or math, mental health, behavior, that scaling up on the system change and reform on how to sustain these programs and keep them going is what we're trying to provide in terms of technical support. We have grants in the area of positive behavior support. Right now we have 71 schools across 20 districts that are involved with positive behavior support. It's the same type of tier approach on the behavior side. And on the response to intervention on the academic side, we have 6 grants in reading and 2 in math, and hope to continue those in the future. Senator Salzman, you asked me to mention the new position at the Department of Education on Early Intervening Services Specialist. We have the position posted, and we are hoping to interview for this in the future. This will help us coordinate some of the efforts internally, because scientific research-based instruction, we hope, will be ever-present in the new No Child Left Behind reauthorization. So we have a lot of potential to align and connect some of our national initiatives and some of our state initiatives. We also have some technical assistance needed for those that are working on early intervening services with our prevention dollars, both at the state level as well as our federal dollars. Chris McHugh mentioned child count before. I didn't bring the actual data, but I have some of it in my head. He is very right that most states have over 50% of their students with disabilities identified as learning disabled. And in Minnesota, we're closer to 28%. And it's true, RLD numbers, the number of students identified, has been dropping. And I think this is in part due to some of the programs that are starting to do some prevention activities. And I suspect that this will continue to be the trend. We also have some students that are being identified in other areas that need attention. That's other health disabilities and autism spectrum disorder. But I want to recognize that our numbers for learning disabilities are continuing to drop. And I don't think that we're going to get improved results if we don't do things differently. And I don't think we can get as far if we don't have the connection between our national initiatives, our state initiatives, a lot of the local efforts, this legislation, parent involvement, and more. I think it's really about connections and alignment and collaboration to make it go as far as it can, including a lot of work with higher education.
Thank you so much. And I truly support the support that the department has given us in this effort. In working with us on the legislation last year, you couldn't have been more supportive. So I want to thank you for that.
And you are confident that the No Child Left Behind revision will affirm and continue the research-based methods in terms of literacy and reading and the prevention programs that you're talking about?
All right, it's my hope. I can't say. It's been supposed to be reauthorized. I think the last look in Ed Daily showed about 128 amendments ranging from A to Z and 0 to 100. So I couldn't promise, of course not.
Well, I had read that there was some align. Controversy around particularly reading first, and that would be very disappointing when you see and what we've heard of the kinds of results that have been attained by this, if in fact there's any effort to abandon that. So I was just wondering if there was reason for your optimism or not. So
I'm just that kind of person, I guess.
We may have to have some concerted effort to try to communicate, at least to our delegation, that we want to see that continue. Because that is bringing the results that I think the overall intent of the legislation was trying to achieve.
Absolutely.
And even though they mucked up in a bunch of other areas, and we don't like to have that kind of entanglement from there, I think that there's some elements that I think we need to be working on, and if it's help prod us in that direction, so that's so much the better.
I think part of my enthusiasm is because I just returned from a National State Directors of Special Education conference, and we had many references by the powers that be at the Office of Special Ed Programs and the U.S. Department of Education that keep talking about aligning NCLB and IDEA. So that is perhaps what is still on the agenda of many of the national organizations pushing for that support for better alignment.
Thank you so much. You. Well, our next testifiers are Lynn Burke and Dr. Laura Wills from a program called Reach Out and Read. We have not heard from them before, but I learned about this particular program, and it's sort of we'll shift gears here a little bit. We've been talking about the age 3 to grade 3, but Reach Out and Read is an exciting program that works with, our healthcare providers in working with parents during well-child visits and really introducing literacy to them. And they have really come on strong in Minnesota. And I think it's exciting for us to hear. We've talked a lot about, you know, three-year-olds, but we've also talked a lot about parents and what's being done to encourage parents to get involved with their kids in literacy. So thank you so much for being here. We are so glad you stayed to talk with us. And if you just introduce yourselves, please, that would be helpful.
Thank you. My name is Laurel Wills. I'm a developmental pediatrician at Hennepin County Medical Center and on faculty in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And I am the medical director for the Minnesota branch of Reach Out and Read, which is a national organization, nonprofit that started at Boston City Hospital about 18 years ago and is now spread coast to coast and has been enthusiastically embraced by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And as we'll talk further in a moment, has a strong and growing evidence base and is one of the most important developmental interventions that we can make in primary care pediatrics. Basically, what the program involves is three components. One is that every baby from the six-month well-child check through to the kindergarten well-child check goes home with a developmentally appropriate children's book. And with that is a second component. We, as baby doctors, have ready access and a remarkable capture opportunity at the earliest ages to start influencing and guiding parents regarding book sharing and concepts like phonemic awareness and promoting and stimulating speech language milestones in children. Again, from the very, very earliest infancy and toddler years. And then thirdly, in clinical settings in family medicine and pediatrics, a major part of the program is to provide literacy-rich environments in the waiting area, in the exam rooms, and so forth. And what that involves is a lot of volunteer readers in our waiting areas, books, magazines, posters, child literacy-oriented materials at everyone's fingertips. Again, we have an unbeatable capture opportunity with parents who are bringing their kids into the doctor anyway, as opposed to a program like ECFE that is fabulous but is a self-selected program largely, or childcare settings, which is not a substitute, but to complement some of those early opportunities. This accesses parents and hooks them up with an authority, a trusted authority figure, to guide them in terms of early book sharing opportunities. And the research is all about infant brain development and speech language milestones in terms of receptive and expressive milestones. And some of the other research data has to do with changing parents' attitudes about books and about, I'm going to leave the teaching of reading to my educational colleagues, but what we're on about is getting parents excited about books and getting kids to love books and to hold books. And I will tell you, as a practitioner, being a pediatrician is not just about baby shots and bicycle helmets and so forth. It's all about developmental assessment. And so using a baby book as part of the clinic visit, it's all about what happens in the exam room. And when I have a 12 or 15-month-old toddler, I can start the visit, distract the daylights out of the kid so I can actually get some things accomplished. Do things like on purpose hand the baby the book upside down, and I'm watching for how they manipulate the book. I'm looking at fine motor skills. I'm looking at speech language skills. I'm modeling for mom and dad how to actually read. And we talk about use the phrase book sharing as opposed to reading. I don't want parents to get their heads stuck into actually reading text with kids, but teaching them how to work with the tempo of different kids. And again, and, you know, just very obviously speech language features. Many of our Spanish and bilingual families ask specifically for bilingual books. They are learning English themselves, just as their children are. And this is a Somali English children's book. This is something I might use at the kindergarten visit, the 4 to 6 year old visit. This is a bilingual English-Spanish book. In the handout packet that you have is a list of some of the published articles in family medicine and pediatrics peer-reviewed journals, highlighting some of these developmental milestones, just as my colleagues previously talked about, monitoring milestone development all along the way through those pre-K years and into the early elementary years. We keep a close eye on kids as they age. And the developmental milestone, or the reading milestones handout that's multicolored, has children's milestones and also things for parents to be doing, very pragmatic tips for parents as the child's developing. And as with my medical school professor hat on, one of the most enjoyable opportunities for me with this program is to be training the next generation of pediatricians and family medicine docs with incorporating literacy into primary care medicine for kids. And I had just a remarkable experience with one of our interns a few weeks ago who I was supervising at a well child check with a 22-month-old child. Within seconds after handing the child the book, it was clear that the child was on the autism spectrum. And so it was one of those most amazing teachable moments where I was not only able to talk with her about literacy milestones, but also core features of autism and use of children's books with the developmental as the part of the developmental assessment. And then another anecdote I would just share is a mom I had a few weeks ago who is a single mom with a couple of little boys, Spanish-speaking, bilingual family. And she was saying that she had had this very difficult time with one of her two boys is particularly feisty in his temperament, and that he had just had this big temper tantrum and was going to run away from home, and she just didn't know what to do about it, and she ended up sort of chasing him down the hallway of their apartment building. I said, have you ever heard of the children's book, The Runaway Bunny? And because she had said she got into this big struggle. I said, this is a classic. It's been around for decades. And this is the Spanish edition of Runaway Bunny. And I said, basically, for people not familiar with this, it is the story of a feisty little person who wants to go off on adventures. And I'm going to run away from you, Mama, and all of this. And the mom keeps her cool and says, I'm going to be a boat and I'm going to sail away. And she says, and essentially my job is to keep you safe. And if you become a boat and you sail away, I will become the west wind and I will blow you, you know, in a direction. Oh, if you're going to be a bird and fly away, I will become a tree and I'll be the nest and you can fly and have an adventure and then come home to the nest and so forth. And she was able to play with that, came back the next visit and said, I can't believe it. He's asking for that book every single night and we're reading and he's getting to bed on time and all sorts of good stuff. This has been just a remarkable change in pediatrics, and it is becoming a core feature that's embedded in this new edition of the Bright Futures Guidelines, which is a American Academy of Pediatrics and Federal Maternal Child Health booklet that guides primary care pediatrics. The national program and federal funding is largely pitched at children who are living in at-risk situations. But again, I would stress the opportunity to work. Starting at HCMC, we send every postpartum mom home with a book. This particular program, Reach Out and Read, starts at that well child check at the 6-month visit. Anything that we all can do to help toddlers and preschoolers be ready for all of the pre-K programming and all of the early elementary programming that you've just talked about, get those parents and kids ready, that's what it's all about. So, and I want to introduce my partner in crime here is Lynn Burke, who is a children's literacy specialist and children's book reviewer, syndicated columnist, and the coordinator for Minnesota Reach Out and Read.
And I just want to talk a little bit about impact. First of all, thanks for
the
opportunity.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
To introduce Reach Out and Read to all of you. I usually use a statistic when I'm training my volunteers, and that is that the average middle-class kid gets about 1,000 hours of one-on-one reading by the time they hit kindergarten. The average poor kid gets 25. So for every hour of one-on-one reading with an adult that a middle-class child gets, a child living in poverty gets 90 seconds. There's no way that these two kids are starting out the same. One of the reasons they don't have reading experiences is because they don't have books at home. Reach Out and Read is a way to get books into the home. By the time a child hits kindergarten, they've received 10 developmentally appropriate books. And if there's more than one kid in the family, they've got more than that. The national statistics are that Reach Out and Read is at 3,300 sites nationally. We've trained 47,000 doctors and nurse practitioners, and we reach nearly 3 million children and give away about 5 million books. In the state of Minnesota, at HCMC, at the beginning of 2003, we were the 6th site in the state of Minnesota. So that was in 2003. Here we are at the end of 2007. We've got 42 active sites, and that does not count the Mayo Clinic, which just came on board, the University of Minnesota Children's Clinic, which just came on board. And as I was typing this all into a spreadsheet so that I would know exactly how many, I noticed that there is a new site in Ely that just completed an application, and St. Luke's in Duluth just handed in an application yesterday. So it's the increase in Minnesota is really dramatic, and it's I think we've reached a tipping point. I don't do any recruitment anymore. People are hearing, doctors are hearing from other doctors, and they know that it's something that they want. It's also a very inexpensive intervention to implement. It costs us, on average, for the books alone, per child, $5.50 a year per child. That's a cup of coffee and a muffin, right? Or maybe, depending on where you go, it's just a cup of coffee. and there's a little bit of admin, but it's a very inexpensive intervention. In Minnesota, we're reaching about 28,000 kids. We've trained about 100 docs, and we're serving about 25% of the low-income children in the state with Reach Out and Read. Obviously, our goal is to reach as many as people as possible, to reach all those kids. In our clinic, we have volunteer readers, and I just wanted to share a story with you. I was talking to Julie, my volunteer that comes in on Monday afternoons, and she told me that there was a Hispanic girl that was really shy, and so instead of trying to get her to come over to the table, she went over and sat down next to her. So this little girl had her mom on one side, and she had Julie on the other. And Julie doesn't speak Spanish, but she had a bilingual book, and she was going through the Spanish. And then the mom took over, and Julie just sort of sat back, and the mom held the book with the child. And later on in her shift, she was sitting at the table reading to a little Somali boy who was about 4 years old. And she said he was sort of interested, and he was catching some of the stuff, but not everything. And the Somali mom came over and sat down and sort of took over, which is exactly what we're trying to do. We're really trying to model a lot of our parents, at least at HCMC. About 50% of our patients are Spanish speakers. Another 15% speak an African language, most often in our case Somali, but sometimes Arabic, sometimes French. And one of our doctors told me yesterday that she had a mom from the Congo who told her how important it was to get the books. And she said, you know, in Africa, we don't read children's books to children. I had no idea that this was an important thing to do. But since you've given me a book, my kid, anytime we go anywhere, when he sees words, he wants to know what it says. And I think, you know, everything that we've said today, we're all on the same team. It's not just the team in a building. It's not just those of us at HCMC. I mean, you know, we've got doctors, we have volunteers, you know, you have people like me who are stocking the shelves, trying to get the books out to the parents. I think we're all on the same team, and I really appreciate the opportunity to let you know what we're doing here. We do have some federal dollars coming in for any site that reaches 25% low income or more. They get a 50% startup, so half of their books are paid for. As the coalition leader, my job is to try to raise another 25% of the book. So no site has to worry that they're not going to be able to do this. And also, last month, we got a $66,000 grant from RIF, which will pay for 75% of the books there are 24 sites whose aggregate population is 80% low income. So there are ways that we can make this work. We're working with individuals. We're working with businesses to try to pull this all together to reach all these kids who really would love to be connected with books if they had the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So. Does Art Rolnick know about you?
I have tried to buttonhole Art Rolnick,
we'll
but I'm sort
that.
Of a fly. But I think that what we do would be a perfect piece of what he does.
Absolutely.
You know, Growth and Justice is doing an event, I believe, on November 12th, and I'm going to be on a panel with Dr. Rolnick. So I'll have a packet for him.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. Are there other questions? And in terms of so funding, there's never, I mean, it's...
The challenge for us is that it's starting to take off so fast. Mm-hmm. When we bring in the University and Mayo Clinic, that's 7,500 children. Well, last year we were reaching 28,000 in the state. In 1 month, we increased by 25%. I mean, I'm paddling as fast as I can and you know, talking to businesses and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. But, man, that's explosive growth. And I am one part-time person, and I am the staff. I am the secretary. I answer the phones. You know, this is it. And
I would echo
you're,
that.
You're with the HCMC, or are you with the Reach Out and Read, the whole?
I do both.
You do both.
I am 50%
okay.
Minnesota Reach Out and Read, the whole state.
Yeah.
And then 50%, I am actually the coordinator of Reach Out and Read at HCMC. And at HCMC, we have taken this program and totally expanded it from 0 to 18.
Very good. Excellent.
Mm. Wonderful.
Yeah, well, I would echo that just to say that my sense, the Bright Futures guidelines are coming out. Lynn's phone is ringing off the hook. I get email messages from physician colleagues constantly, you know, how can I find out more about this program? We need this in our clinic. I've heard a bit about this, and so physicians are excited about this too.
And it's almost, I would say, more than half of the clinics or the children we reach in the state of Minnesota are outside the metro.
Which is great. Well, thank you so much. We have your information here. I'm sure you'll be hearing from some of us as we follow up on these initiatives. Well, I would like to thank everyone for staying past our 12 o'clock noon time. Our next meeting, we're going to be, it's a field trip, and we've heard a lot about the problem solving, team teaching, bringing teachers together. So we will be visiting SCRED and watching one of those grade level team meetings taking place. I'm not sure we can have an auditorium full of people there, but if you are interested, please let us know about that. I would like to also, I'm not sure if our support team is back over here behind the pillars, but we have had some parents who are working with us are very interested in the staff development, so they've been cheering us on. As you've heard, that will probably be the topic of our next committee meeting, and Senator Olson will be the chair of that meeting. This is something that I think she has tremendous leadership on and understands it just so very well. So we, again, thank you for being here, and our meeting adjourned.
Good.